So without further ado, we'll hear from Mr. Robinson in the U.S. versus Moore case 23171.
Good morning, Your Honor, and good morning, Judge Phillips and Judge Seymour. On behalf of Jamarius Moore, thank you for agreeing to hear this appeal. This case focuses on the interplay between the federal sentencing statute 18 U.S.C. 3553A and private sentencing bargains that are made between a district court and a defendant. Mr. Moore's position in this matter is that sentencing bargains between a district court and a defendant are permissible to the extent that whatever sentence is imposed under that bargain is also justified under the federal sentencing statute, 18 U.S.C. 3553A. Mr. Moore is unaware of anything in the law that allows a sentencing bargain to override Congress's authority as stated in Section 3553A. Subsection A1 states that a district court shall impose a sentence sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with subsection A2. Mr. Moore did not waive this court's review of this error because he did not initiate the sentencing bargain in this case, and he did not thereafter agree to waive the provisions of 3553A2.
Can I ask you about defense counsel's statement on page 201 of the record where he says that this is a good idea, this will help keep my client on track? Is his statement that Judge Broome's offer would be helpful to his client, was that in effect an invitation for Judge Broome's to do exactly what he's suggested?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I was trial counsel for Mr. Moore, and I'm the one that made those statements. And what we were dealing with at that point was for the court to leave open certain options. And by agreeing to let the court leave open certain options, the intent was, and I don't think the record shows that it otherwise was meant to cause a waiver of the 3553A factors or anything like that. The idea with giving Mr. Moore this opportunity was that if he failed, the court could come back and resentence him. But in the course of any resentencing, the court would have to justify any decision that it made, not only under the sentencing bargain, which was pretty wide open in terms of what the court could do, but also under Section 3553A.
Let me ask you just a question as far as the direction of this case. Probation violation, revocation hearing, Rule 32.1, in comes the defendant, the court gets the admitted violations. Then we're to a statute nobody really is talking about, which is 3565A2. And what that directs is to a resentencing. The court can have a resentencing. Now, you seem to focus on 7B1.4, but why isn't it just a complete redo? Resentencing, the court looks these 51 to however many months, 63, I think it was, and then varies up, not by a lot, and gives reasons why. I think you ran, I think you're dangerous, so forth, so on. Why is that not an easy affirmance, even if you didn't invite the error?
Well, we agree that the court could, under 3565A2, revoke the sentence of probation and resentence Mr. Moore. The court could have done that, and I think that's essentially what the court did. But in doing that, in resentencing Mr. Moore, the court was still bound to apply the 3553A factors. And what the court found on the record was that in the absence of the sentencing bargain, just applying what happened to Mr. Moore or what Mr. Moore did both pre-sentencing and post-sentencing, that the court would not have arrived at an outcome of 84 months, that it would have been looking more along the subchapter C guidelines or recommendations of 5 to 11 months. And again, the court could have resentenced Mr. Moore within the guidelines, the 51 to 63 months. And had the court done that, Mr. Moore probably would not have a basis for appeal. But the court made an upward variance and found that, but for the existence of the sentencing bargain, that variance was not justified under all the other facts applied to 3553A.
Well, let me ask you a structural question, which is, and tell me if you think the district court would be allowed to do this. In comes the defendant, there's a probation violation admitted. The court says, I'm looking at 3565A2, and it tells me I can resentence under subchapter A, which is a redo. I'm going to look at my old PSR. I'm going to see it's 51 to 63 months, and I'm going to vary up, and I'm going to give some reasons for that. Next point, the probation violation itself, it would be punished under 7B1.4, which would be a separate sentence either on top of or concurrent to the 3565A2 sentence. In other words, it's two pieces. The district court chose only to use piece one here, which would be a benefit to your client. What's wrong with that?
That's not something that I've considered, honestly. I hadn't thought about the idea of revoking and resentencing and then also sentencing for the probation violation as well and running those consecutive. To be honest with you, Your Honor, that's not something that I contemplated. And I suppose that might be possible, but I think that I don't understand enough of the interplay between a resentencing and having that sentence be within the guidelines based on the 3553A factors, but then using the probation violation revocation as an indirect way of affecting an upward variance. I don't understand. I don't know enough about the interplay between those two to give you a very informed answer. I apologize.
Oh, no. Thank you very much.
I had a question, but Judge Seymour, I think you might have had a question. Do you have a question?
I can't remember what it was.
Well, when you think of it, interrupt me. But Ms. Robinson, let me ask you a question about what you were addressing. And I'll put it in a hypothetical. Let's say Mr. Moore was charged and for these same crimes. And at pretrial, the parties agree that that Mr. Moore would be released, even though, let's say, the rebuttable presumption would hypothetically support detention. And for a number of reasons, maybe because of COVID-19, that it gets continued for several years, maybe even 4 years before trial. And everybody agrees, say, to an ends of justice exception under the Speedy Trial Act. And he is convicted. And then the district judge at sentencing says, boy, Mr. Moore, and there is, I should say, a terrible violation. He's caught, thousands of miles away, just as this case is. But this is a pretrial violation as opposed to a supervised release violation. And the district judge at sentencing, Judge Broom, says, you know, if you had abided by the conditions, then I would have given you, a guideline sentence or maybe even probation, you know, something very lenient. But you violated a trust. You were given this enormous opportunity. You really should have been detained, but for whatever reason, you were allowed to be on release. And because you breached that trust at pretrial, he is going to stiffen the sentence, just like many district judges do all of the time. using the factors under 3553 or 3661 in the Pepper case to say that when a defendant violates a court's trust at pretrial, on pretrial release, then that may justify stiffening the sentence. So why is it, if a judge can do that, is the premise of my question, why can't the judge do that at for a supervised release violation?
Okay, so the distinction that I make between your hypothetical and the facts that we have in our case is, in your hypothetical, the court would be making findings that, based on the offense conduct and based on the conduct pre-trial, that under 3553A, that justifies an upward variance.
Well, I suppose, but I'm not talking about offense conduct. I'm really not talking about the 3553 factors. What I am saying is that just the fact that the defendant breached the trust by committing a violation while on release would be, I would think, a permissible factor. It's considered all the time at sentencing for pretrial violations. Now, that's not going to be found in the seven factors in 3553A, but judges do it all the time, and I don't know why they couldn't.
Well, give me one moment. Well, I think that under what you're talking about, if someone performs that way or behaves that way pre-trial, then that might be something that the court could consider under 3553A1, which is the history and characteristics of the defendant.
Okay.
So
then, isn't it the same thing here? I mean, he's on probation. He violates the rules. Doesn't that go to the same thing here?
It does, in a way. But the problem that we have in this case is the district court found specifically that just looking at those things, the offense conduct and the conduct while out of custody, if you just look at those things, that those facts don't justify an upward variance.
Yes, but this was after that. He found that earlier. This is what the defendant did, and it was a breach of trust, even though breaches weren't horrible. But doesn't that go to the characteristics of the defendant?
Well, I think it does, but the court made the finding that based on everything outside the realm of the sentencing bargain, that a guideline sentence would be appropriate. And that's really where we have the issue in this case, is that the court said, if I look at everything that you've done and I set the sentencing bargain aside, if I just look at everything that you've done, then I arrive at a guideline sentence. But because we add this one fact in, the existence of this sentencing bargain, we're now looking at an upward variance. And so the court looked at all those facts that you're talking about and said that if you just look at those facts, that an 84-month sentence isn't justified. I would like to, if possible, reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Oh, sure. Karen, let's stop the clock. This is not cutting into your rebuttal. Judge Seymour, do you have any other questions?
No.
Okay. Judge Phillips, do you?
No, thank you.
Okay. You have a minute and 23 for rebuttal, Ms. Rosen. Okay, Ms. Gordon.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your Honor, I'd like to start first with the concept of invited error. In his reply brief, the defendant seems to confuse Genesis with affirmatively endorse. And in fact, Judge Phillips just issued a published opinion on August 23rd in United States versus William addressing invited error, where the language of the court there said that invited error prevents a party from inducing action by the court. So that case was about restitution, but this court held that the defendant in that case had invited any potential error by agreeing to a restitution amount. So there's nothing in the case law that requires the defendant to be the one that comes up with the ultimate idea that the court adopts. And although the defendant in this case first asked for probation, He later changed his request. It was an evolving situation, and he did change his request to he originally asked for time served, and then he changed his request to probation, and specifically said that gives the court the ability to introduce a years long term sentence at the end of it. So the defendant was certainly well aware of what would occur. Because of the invited error doctrine, appellate review on this case should be should ultimately be denied.
Is there any limit, which is to say, here the district court said you're going to get 7 years, and then in fact gave 7 years? What if the district court would have said, I take these violations so seriously that if you come back before me for spitting on the sidewalk, the classic example, it's 20 years, sir. And he says, okay, I'll sign up for that. And then he spits on the sidewalk. Would you be in here saying invited error 20 years?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that I think what's important is that the sentencing agreement was created in consideration of 3553A factors. And the court, even though it had the sentencing agreement, it still made the analysis later on. And it said that the fact that he was found in Seattle, Washington, the day before his compliance hearing, changed the complexity of it entirely.
You're moving away from invited error now, though. And my question is, would you say 20 years would be fine? The district court doesn't even have to look at 3553A because there was a bargain and the defendant accepted it.
Well, I think the invited error doctrine, I mean, this court has upheld it when it says that the defendant affirmatively endorses something at the district court and then agrees to it. So that is certainly an extreme example, Your Honor. I don't know at what point the limits of invited error have been tested to that degree. But in the cases that I've reviewed on invited error from the circuit, when the defendant induces action, and the Williams case, which was just decided last month, was, and I'm sure you're aware because you wrote it, but it was about a restitution amount over $1 million that arguably was more than the defendant would have owed, but the defendant agreed to it.
Isn't it a problem that the district court says, if you come back, it's 7 years. And in fact, the sentence is 7 years. It's all decided in advance. And the rest of it is just window dressing. Sounds like to me, the court justified its earlier promise that it was going to give 84 months. And isn't that a problem? As Judge Posner said, first we sentence and then we do the trial, basically.
Well, so, Your Honor, and I believe you're referencing the 28J letter, and I didn't file a response. I'm happy to file a formal response, but I have something prepared to address it. The defendant filed a 28J letter on United States versus Tatum, which is the Judge Posner decision you're referencing. I think importantly, that Seventh Circuit decision from 7 years ago, first of all, it didn't have the invited error component. And second of all, it was all in discussion of an Anders brief. So the court didn't
agree on all of that.
Yes.
I'm not saying that it's binding in any fashion or that Judge Posner made a determinative ruling. I'm asking you the question, isn't it a problem in our circuit today, as we're arguing this case, that the district court pre-announced its decision?
Well, the reason I think it's not, Your Honor, is for the same reason that in the United States versus Keating, which I found in looking in the 28J letter, it's a Eighth Circuit case at 787 F3rd 1197. But they looked at the Tatum case, and in Keating, it was a felon in possession with a guideline range of 30 to 37 months. And the district court did exactly what this court did here, where it said, I'll give you a year and a day today, or you can have 5 years probation. But if you come back here, I'm going to sentence you to the 10-year maximum. And he came back within 30 days, and he gave him a 10-year sentence. The Eighth Circuit upheld it, and it said that so long as the court properly considered the 3553A factors in addition to this agreement they had, that there was no error. Now, again, I appreciate that's not binding, but I think that really goes on here. And I think what's important is, in the defendant's reply brief, he says that the crux of appeal occurs and the language regarding when the district court said, this might be a different thing if I were just looking at the C violations that might be different. What I think is important is when the court's doing that, it's in response to a question that Mr. Robinson gave the court. The court went through its analysis, announced the opinion, and Mr. Robinson said something to the effect, what should I tell my clients in the future if they have a grade C violation? What should they expect? And the court was saying, well, in a normal situation, if it's just a grade C violation, I'm not necessarily going to max everyone out. But he said here, you know, he avoided this major sentencing time. And I think what's important is Mr. Robinson says the crux of appeals on pages 119 to 120 of the third volume of the record. But if you continue reading on to page 121, the district court says, with respect to this particular case, if we were only talking about the violations in paragraphs 19 through 22, which would have been he went to Wichita when he shouldn't have, and there was something else, relatively minor. He said, we might have a different discussion. But when he fled to Seattle, Washington, that changes the complexity of this entirely. So the court is making, you know, even though the court said, I'm bound by this and I want to let you know, I know what I'm saying. The court still said that the fact was the day before the compliance hearing, he's found 1,000 miles away in a stolen car with people who have felony warrants.
So I'm clear. Are you saying that the district court varied up from the 5 to 11 range? That's how it reached its 84 months. Is it varied up from the 7B1.4 range?
I think, Your Honor, that he took it as his chance to resentence on the original crime, which is an armed robbery where someone was shot.
Well, then why are we talking about grade C violations and criminal history threes and all of that? And the probation office gives the district court a 7B1.4. Everyone's expecting that it's going to be a 5 to 11 range, the government, probation, the defense counsel. If it's a brand new resentencing, then why didn't the court ever say, well, as we left this off, it was 51 to 63, and I'm going to vary up by 21 months?
Your Honor, I think that when you read the transcript, the court did go back through and he read on in the revocation hearing or the resentencing, whatever you'd like to call it, in August of 2020. He went back through the course of the three prior hearings that spanned 6 months where this whole development had occurred.
It's not what I want to call it. It's what you want to call it. Are you calling it a resentencing? Or are you calling it a revocation under 7B1.4? Just so I know the starting place on what the variance is.
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. And it's labeled a revocation hearing, but the district court, I think if you read the transcript, I think the district court looked at it as the opportunity to resentence on the underlying crime. But I also think that it's kind of in conjunction, it's kind of a hybrid because the district court also took note to talk about the conduct that had occurred since the underlying crime. So I think it's kind of an interesting hybrid, but this is an interesting case. And I think it's interesting because the district court took such care to come up with a unique sentence for this defendant in consideration of 3553A factors, that he did something a little unusual, but something that I think Congress talks about the need for a sentence for each individual defendant.
Well, if we're unsure, and it sounds like you're kind of unsure, if we're unsure if the applicable range was 5 to 11 or instead 51 to 63, don't we have to remand so the district court can tell us that and then we can measure the degree of the variance?
I don't think that remand is necessary, Your Honor, because I think that either way that, well, first of all, I think invited error weighs the whole thing. And second of all, I think that no matter which way you look at it, the variance is still supported by the record that the court made. The court made a thorough record that I think needs to be read in conjunction and no single part can be read in a vacuum. So I think that whether it's a variance from the original guideline sentence or whether it's a variance from the revocation, I think it's still supported within by the statute and by the record. Does the court have any other questions?
I do not.
Okay. I think the record is supported by the fact that invited error precludes this court from review. But even if the court reviews this, the record is both procedurally and substantively reasonable. Excuse me, the sentence is both procedurally and substantively reasonable. Over the course of three hearings that spanned 6 months, the court examined the 3553A factors in coming up with this sentencing bargain. The court discussed the nature and circumstances of the offense, the history and characteristics of the defendant, the rehabilitative potential, and the consequence the need for just punishment and deterrence. Throughout the course of all this is how the court came up with the sentencing agreement.
And can I ask you one last question on the sentencing agreement, since I'm not running out of time? Why did the court do a 6-month beginning, let's see how you do, good faith period, if it was going to sentence on a probation basis anyway? Why couldn't it have just sentenced him to the same sentence without the 6 months trial period?
That's a great question, Your Honor. And I obviously can't speak for Judge Brooms and the decision that he made, but if I had to guess based on the record, it would just be to see if it was even feasible, because it was such a serious crime. The armed robbery was such a serious thing. Maybe it was just saying, we'll give you a trial run and see if this is even feasible. And if you do well in the 6 months, then I'll give you this opportunity to continue to stay out.
Well, the reason that I ask is because it suggests to me that the district court thought the district court didn't have the ability to fully resentence this defendant and didn't want to sacrifice the ability later on to impose more than a 2-year or more than a guideline 7B1.4 sentence. And whether that matters or not may be debatable, but that's the only reason I can see why the district court would have done it that way.
Right. I certainly appreciate what you're saying. And I can't say exactly why he did it the way he did, other than what he referred to it as in the record was a trial run to see if it would be feasible. Because, you know, the major thing the defendant was saying was that he hadn't had the opportunity to have these mentors, and there were these men in the courtroom who said they were going to mentor him. And I don't know if it was a trial run just for the defendant or also for the men in the courtroom who said that they were going to be there and be willing to participate in potential rehabilitative efforts. So I can't say for certain, but I think that might have had a play in it, because there were a lot of moving parts, is my understanding from the record. So that's what I think how it went. So
that's a helpful answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Like I said, the sentence was procedurally reasonable based on 3553A factors. And I also think it's important that, as this court noted, by the time that he's being sentenced to the 84 months, I think the defendant keeps arguing that the court originally said that a guideline sentence was appropriate. But the fact is that time and things had changed. So he was not compliant on his probation, even after an extraordinary extension of grace from the district court after an armed robbery where the defendant himself had a gun and someone was shot, not by the defendant, but his co-defendant ended up being shot during the course of the robbery.
Ms. Gordon, let me ask you, with regard to your argument that Judge Brooms did consider the 3553A factors, and your points are certainly well taken, there's no question that Judge Brooms did introduce a factor that can only generously be construed as to be within the 3553A factors, and that is that he needed a, quote, hammer to hold over the defendant to deter him from violating his conditions. And now 3661 does allow considerations that are with regard to perhaps outside 3553A, or at least a gloss on offense and characteristics of the defendant. But holding a hammer over the defendant to have a 2-year window that would be harsher than the defendant would otherwise get, how can that possibly be permissible under Pepper, under 3661 or 3553A, or any of our case law on substantive reasonableness?
Your Honor, I think that under 3553A, one of the factors is deterrence. I know I've gone over my time. Am I allowed to answer that?
Please.
So I believe that having that as a deterrent factor, and in fact, the defense counsel himself said having this threat of a long jail sentence is helping him to comply. And I mean, that's the defendant's own admission that this potential issue in the future is one factor of deterrence that's going to help me. And so I think that the district court was willing to use the factors really do what Congress and the courts have asked the district court judges to do, which is be on the gut, be on the front line, look at people, make individualized sentencing decisions. And in this opportunity, he did try to give someone a chance. I mean, let's not forget the fact that this defendant was out of custody for over a year. He received the benefit of this bargain and he didn't complain. He didn't file an appeal in the 10th Circuit during the year he was out of custody to say that the sentence he was given was improper. Instead, he took a year out of custody and enjoyed his life, but he made the wrong decisions and he didn't do what he needed to do. And so the fact that the court said, excuse me.
No, you go ahead.
Thank you. Just the fact that the court, you know, his verbiage, the fact that he said he needed a hammer, again, there's no magic words. The court, you know, was referencing the deterrence factor that, and again, the defendant admitted that that was helpful to him. So for those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm that.
Is there a difference between deterring the commission of a violation of conditions that are non-criminal and the deterrence of criminality? Now, the deterrence of criminality is certainly a factor under 3553A. I don't see anything in 3553A to suggest that a court can impose a harsher sentence in order to deter someone from committing violations of conditions of supervised release or to deter other defendants in the future, as Judge Brooms made it clear that was part of his intent.
Your Honor, there is 10th Circuit case law concerning the ability to use the deterrent factor as a reason to deter others. And in terms of the non-criminal conduct, I think, again, the court always looked at this as a continuum and looked to see deterrence of the violent bankrupt. You know, he said something like, someone had a gun pointed at them. I want to them to understand there's a sense of justice. So I think it was a continuum.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Seymour, do you have any other questions?
No.
Okay. Judge Phillips, do you?
No.
Okay. Ms. Robinson?
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the last point that you were talking about, the use of non-criminal conduct to increase a sentence, I think that might be addressed in United States versus Griffin, which is this court's case in 2009 at 584 F3rd 1004. And in that case, it was agreeing with a dissent from Judge Tashima of the Ninth Circuit, which talks about whether it's okay to have an upward variance based on non-criminal conduct. In terms of the invited error that the government claims occurred, if Mr. Moore had proposed this bargain to begin with, if he said, Judge, this is what I propose, then I think we might be in an invited error situation. But
we have jury instruction cases where the defendant just went along with the instruction, didn't propose it, where the court has imposed invited error. How are those distinguishable?
I'm not following you. I'm sorry.
Well, you're saying this wasn't our idea. We just went along with it. And yet the 10th Circuit has jury instruction cases where it's not the defendant's proposed instruction, but the court turns to the defense counsel at the instruction conference and says, any problems? And defense counsel says, none here, Judge. And we have enforced invited error in that situation. It sounds awfully much like your situation, but I may be missing something.
Well, I'm not recalling those cases to be able to distinguish them from what we have. But what I would note in this particular case is that there's nothing in the record to show that Mr. Moore was inviting the court to cast aside Section 3553A. All Mr. Moore was doing and all I was doing was noting that the court has the ability going forward, if Mr. Moore violates the deal, to give Mr. Moore a significant prison term. And in fact, if you fast forward to the resentencing or the final sentencing hearing, whatever you want to call it, had the court found, if the court made the finding of, you know, based on everything that you did in the case and based on everything you did on your probation violations, I now find that an upward variance of whatever is appropriate, then we would be dealing with a different situation. But here we have the court specifically saying that under everything that we typically look at under 3553A, it doesn't command the result that I'm getting to. The reason I'm getting the result I'm getting to is simply because I'm going to enforce the bargain that we made. And the issue in this appeal at bottom is that if the court's going to do something like that, it has to be able to also justify it under the 3553A factors. And in this case, the court expressly did not do that. And that's why we are here today. Thank you.
Mr. Robinson, I have remembered the question I was going to ask. Weren't you the one that proposed probation as a solution when the district court was worried that a supervised release violation wouldn't give him enough flexibility?
Yes. So what happened is we were at the sentencing and we asked for the time served. And then Judge Broom made the comment about the hammer. And then actually one of my colleagues who was at the sentencing pulled me aside and said, hey, here's a thought. And so we stopped for a moment and then we came back and said, Judge, if this is what you want to be able to do, if you want to be able to have the ability to impose a sentence of more than 2 years, if he makes significant, bad decisions, then probation is a way that you can do that.
Isn't that inviting the error?
No, it is not inviting the court to cast aside 3553A for all future purposes. If the judge wants to sentence Mr. Moore for violating his probation, the federal statutes provide a way to do that. And they say that in doing that, you still have to look at the 3553A factors.
And our standard of review is plain error, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Under plain error, on your procedural reasonableness challenge, you said on page 8 of your opening brief that anyone who, and this isn't a quote, I hope it's a fair paraphrase, that anyone looking at this for the first time would decide that, well, the defendant was promised this, and he got exactly what he had agreed to. Now, you very ably and effectively dismantle, through great advocacy, that perspective. But if the public, as you openly acknowledge, would look at this in that way, how can this at prong 4 be considered to have an error, even if obvious, that seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or reputation of the judicial proceedings, if anyone looking at this for the first time would in fact see that the defendant got exactly what he was offered and promised and got?
Well, under prong 4, I'm not sure that the standard is necessarily what an outsider looking at it for the first time would think. As to that prong, our view is that if you're going to allow district courts to enter into private deals that cast aside federal sentencing statutes and let district courts do whatever they want and the defendant wants to do or agrees to do, then you're essentially creating another entirely different mechanism for sentencing defendants in federal court. And by doing that, you're saying that district courts have the ability to, by offering deals to defendants, usurp all of Congress's intention in setting up 3553A. And simply by creating a new mechanism or a new structure, that is contrary to the fourth prong.
Thank you. Judge Phillips, do you have any additional questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Seymour? Let me ask, Counsel, Mr. Robinson, within 5 business days would you submit a 28-J letter? Please don't, there's no need for argument, but if you could just give us the site in writing for the U.S. versus Griffin site that you referred to today. And within 5 business days, Ms. Gordon, if you would submit a 28-J letter with the site of the Keating opinion that you cited today. I do thank both counsel, Ms. Gordon and Mr. Robinson, for your excellent, I thought both sides did an excellent job in your briefs and in your oral arguments today. And we appreciate your fine advocacy. This matter will be submitted.